Hey there, partners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrant. Today's guest is Dave Vasu. He is the founder of Powered by Search, which is a digital marketing agency for enterprise customers. He started from scratch right after his undergrad and built a major company out of it. Actually, let me start with that question right away, Dave. What's your revenue or projected revenue in 2016?
Hey, Rohit, thanks for having me. Our projected revenue at the end of 2016 should be just under $6 million.
Under $6 million, and you started from scratch and completely bootstrapped the company.
That's right.
So let me go back a little bit and understand your story. So what was your childhood like? Where were you born and how did you end up in where you are right now?
That's an interesting question. I've lived in many different places around the world, but I was born in Calcutta, India, and I didn't really grow up there when I was very, very young right after I was born. So when I was about a year old, my parents moved to Canada and specifically to Toronto. I grew up here till I was about 4 years old, and then we moved back to India where we kind of, you know, did this diamond around India, moved from Calcutta, Delhi, Bombay, and Bangalore. And then finally, when I was 16, I moved back to Canada.
What was your dad doing that made your family travel so much?
He was just changing jobs. He worked in the printing industry and had different opportunities, basically, that took him to other parts of the country. And so the family went along with it. So you could say that I've got very used to moving in my life.
I see. Actually, having a different environment every few years, I've known friends from younger days who parents were in military, for example. So they have a different perspective on life in general. They make friends quicker, and I've seen them have a different perspective. So did it help or hurt in any way?
It actually helped, I'd say. I mean, the hardest part was moving away from roots that you were just starting to put down. But it helped in being much more adaptable. So making friends quickly, learning how to be, you know, likable and funny, for example, just understanding how to listen more so you can empathize with people. Mm-hmm. Those types of things are skills that, you know, you have to develop when you're moving that much and having to kind of assimilate into a brand new sort of environment and community early on.
So when one such brand new community is Canada at 16, right? At 16 is one of the hardest years of your life, right? Like you get picked on by friends for even having a different colored shirt than the normal or whatever. So you moved all the way from India to Canada, which is culturally very different. Did you have any challenges integrating into the Canadian social structure?
You know, yes and no. I think that I found it as a new experience. I took it on in stride for what it was, and I actually made the most of it. And I think that was very similar to the other experiences that I've had in my life as well, where if I was moving to some place, I kind of associated or conditioned myself to look at the positives out of that particular experience. Mm-hmm. So, you know, grade 12 is the only high school year I did in Canada, and then I moved into my undergrad right after. And grade 12 was definitely very different in Canada than it was in India. Mm-hmm. So I'd say school was definitely a different experience. Working for the first time was a very big difference as well. I had a part-time job, and that was my first real job, you could say.
What was the job?
So I was a sales associate at a camera store in retail in a mall, basically.
Okay.
And that was kind of an interesting experience, going through the interviewing process and getting an actual job, having to balance school as well as work. Those are things that I wasn't used to doing in India when I'd moved at the age of 16.
But you didn't get picked on by your friends, or you didn't have a hard time with your...
No, thankfully not. I actually had a very, you know, it was interesting. I had friends of all different sort of walks of life in school. That's the other thing in India that was different. You had sort of a very sort of homogeneous type of crowd of types of students. I actually went to a boys' school in Calcutta. So you could say that, you know, the types of friends I had and the types of ambitions and the backgrounds as well were very similar in many ways. And coming to Canada, I had friends, everybody who was in a friend who was in a mechanics program, and the other person was in an advanced placement program who wanted to become a PhD in physics. So it was quite the wide range, basically. And being able to get along with all those different types of people allowed me to be a bit of a social butterfly, at least in that grade 12 year.
You went to University of Toronto for your undergrad, and you took marketing major. And one of your co-ops at Microsoft, you bumped into a problem. What was the problem?
Yes, this was an interesting problem that probably launched the rest of my digital marketing career. The problem basically was that we had an intranet called SharePoint, and it's something that, you know, a lot of people use for storing and collaborating with files. Now, it's also used as a hacky solution for actually creating a website. Now, what I did was I worked with OEM manufacturers. So basically, whenever you go into a store, you're buying a computer, you might have Windows installed on it. The team that was responsible at Microsoft for putting Windows on that computer and having that relationship work was my team, the OEM team. So I used to work with 300 plus resellers and a number of larger brands like Dell, Lenovo, and MDG, sending them promotional codes that were, you know, marketing promotions basically for the month. So all in all, what ended up happening was I was getting these emails, 300 to 400 emails basically per month saying, "Hey, Deb, what's the code?" And I'd have to send out the same email every single time. Eventually, I got pretty frustrated. I asked them to start looking for it online because I thought, hey, we own Microsoft.ca. We had a search engine called MSN.ca at that point. Go search on the search engine and you'll find it. And it was a good hypothesis, but it didn't quite work out that way. So they said, "Deb, I looked for it, didn't find it at the end of the day." And so I told them to do what I should.
So people would search for it and... But they couldn't find it. Okay.
They couldn't find it. So I told them what I shouldn't have told them working at Microsoft, which was to Google it. And they said, "I tried Googling it and they couldn't find it either." So at that point, I said, "This is embarrassing. I mean, we built the website and we can't find it using a search engine that we built as well. Let's go fix this problem." So I went to a VP at that point, raised the problem. And she said, "Yes, this is important to solve. Go solve it. Here's a budget. Go to our creative agency and figure out how to make that happen." So I did. And
before we go on further, right? So
yes,
a lot of people bump into problems, but very few go to their VPs and tell them, I'm going to fix it, right? So what made you make the choice?
Well, so I knew that it was very inefficient for me to continue applying this time, you know, sending out essentially the same email for very similar but, you know, different sets of queries of incoming emails.
So it was a frustration.
I was frustrated with it. You know, I couldn't work on things that were more productive, couldn't be more effective. Mm-hmm. So that was one, definitely one motivating factor. But I was just, you know, honestly, it was an itch that I had to scratch where I was just like, I don't understand why this problem exists or what needs to be done to solve it. But I mean, damn well, I'm going to find out. Mm-hmm. So when I had already done a lot of reading and things like that, and I was hitting a brick wall, is when I went to my VP and I said, "Okay, this is important. We need to solve this because it's a problem that will continue to exist even when I'm no longer in this role, or maybe you're not in your role, but Microsoft will continue seeing this problem."
Yeah. I was expecting you to say, for example, that, "Oh, I wanted to stand out from the crowd and went to the VP," but you were very problem focused and you just wanted to solve that one. And what happened when you reached out to them and, what happened after? Did you get the budget?
Yeah, so I reached out to the creative agency that had built the portal basically for housing all of these promotional codes, and they gladly accepted a six-figure check to fix the problem. Mm-hmm. And 90 days went by, and the problem wasn't fixed. And so they came back and said, "Well, I'm really sorry, but here's the thing: it's the algorithm. We don't really know the algorithm." So we tried our best to do this, and we actually, you know, here's our time log basically, and things like that, and it is what it is. The algorithm changes all the time. We can't figure out the secret sauce that search engines basically use to rank content. Mm-hmm. And so that was that. And it was almost like it was swept under the rug at that point in time. And we went on with our lives, but it's something that kept, you know, for me, it was still in my brain where I'm going, "Hey, the problem's not solved. Mm-hmm. There was no questions being asked over here. Clearly something is broken in this entire picture, basically. Mm-hmm. There is some confusion that exists. There is no clarity. What can I do to bring clarity to this particular situation?"
So you saw the problem that ranking in search, even MSN search, which their own company built, was not an easy thing to do. So if that was a problem for a company for internal content using an internal search engine, it must be the problem for everybody using an external search engine like Google and stuff.
Yeah, well, this is actually an external search engine. MSN.ca at the time is basically what Bing.com is today.
Yeah.
So Bing launched, you know, a couple of years after, but it was an external search engine. I mean, it would have been one thing if it was not found in an internal search, which, you know, you can tweak the algorithm, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. But on an external search engine, you really can't. The algorithm belongs to the company that designed the search engine, and we weren't going to change the algorithm to benefit us, because that's the type of stuff that got Microsoft into a DOJ case, right?
Yeah.
An antitrust case, basically. So you have to be impartial in the way that you rank any content.
Okay, I got it. Yeah. I didn't see that portion. So you went back to school and you finished your undergrad degree. What did you do on the day after the final exam of your undergrad degree?
So I want to back up a little bit and just talk about it. So after I finished at my co-op at Microsoft and went back to school, I already had the bug. So I started a blog. I was blogging about my experiences, learning about search engine optimization.
What was the blog? And
it was called Daily Moolah. It's now defunct. It doesn't exist anymore.
Daily what? Sorry?
Daily Moolah, like Moolah being a synonym for money, basically.
How do you spell it? I want to go to the Wayback Machine and look at it.
You're gonna find it. Maybe you'll find it. Yeah. Moolah is spelled MOOLAH.com.
Oh, Moolah. Oh, got it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I started that, and it started off as a how to make money online blog. Mm-hmm. And this was just purely like a personal experiment to document the learnings that I had. I started applying it because I didn't have a company at that point in time. I didn't have clients. This was back in 2006. I was just basically blogging about how I could promote other people's products using affiliate marketing and organic SEO. Mm-hmm. That went pretty well. And then eventually I caught a bug around local search. And that was being able to showcase businesses in Google's local search results. And Google Maps at that point in time had just started showing results within, when you just search Google, you get the first page. That's known as a universal search result. Mm-hmm. And you started seeing these map results showing up on top. And nobody really knew how they were really powered. So I made it my mission to know exactly everything inside out about it. And that's what Daily Moolah transformed into later on into devbasu.com, where I started talking about local SEO. Today, you're not going to find any local SEO content on devbasu.com. It's more about entrepreneurship and inspiration and motivation related topics. Mm-hmm. So back to that.
So who do you help? Who do you help using these local search techniques? Do you just figure it out? As in, what did you figure it out on? Was there a website that you built to test all your theories? How did you learn?
Yeah, so at that point in time, so after I built the blog, I started consulting for two other agencies. I was an in-house SEO as well, so I'm kind of compressing a lot of different roles into a short period of time until I had that final exam basically happen. One of the things that I was hired for was I was a director of online marketing for an agency that worked for the Yellow Pages group. Mm-hmm. And they allowed me basically this opportunity to build up a digital marketing agency within a very traditional print-based agency. If you think about Yellow Pages, the actual, the thick books basically. And so that allowed me the opportunity to work with businesses that had multiple locations. And these multiple locations needed to find, get found on the web, basically, when somebody was looking for either what they do or maybe by their name, for example. Mm-hmm. And if they weren't able to be seen on Google, on Google Maps, that's a problem that I helped solve. So I was able to connect a local consumer with a local business, but at scale. So think that, today we do it for businesses that have 1,000-plus locations or 3,000-plus locations.
Yeah, got it. I'm just looking at the dailymoolah.com. It's an okay website. It has how to make money out of your blog life. And it forwarded to thriftystudent.net at some point of time.
That was another site I owned, which was a forum, basically.
I see.
And it's always embarrassing to go look back at 10 years of work, basically.
Yeah, we all have the graveyard full of online footprint.
Right? Yes. Yes.
So I've built a lot of bad websites as well. And I'm looking at devbasu.com from 2007. And I see there was a lot of content in there, free SEO audit, there were services you were offering, Zoom enabled iTunes modules, positioning. So it seems like very in-depth content, and it looks like a proper professional SEO company at this point. And this was from August 2008. So you did run it like a proper SEO company. Was it just you, or did you have any others?
No, it was just myself. I was consulting at that point. And also I was working full time while I was in school, which brings me to your question about sort of what happened after the final exam. So in 2009, after my final exam, I decided to, school's done now. I've got a bunch of free time, basically. Mm-hmm. Let's start a company. And so I incorporated Powered by Search the day after the final exams were done.
So when we were talking earlier, when you said I incorporated on the day after the final exam, it it sounded a big move, a strange for me, right? How can you have the courage and all? But now I understand when I saw devbasu.com, you had a business going before that. So you had the confidence. What revenues were you bringing with devbasu.com using the local clients?
So, I mean, I had a mix of income streams at that point. I had, you know, a full-time job. I had some consulting that I was doing as well. Potentially it was in the, you know, very, like low six figures at that point in time.
I see. Low six figures as a student, combined, as a side income is really good, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you incorporated on the final, day of your exams. And,
yes.
What happened in the first week after incorporating?
Oh, that was an interesting. So I was building the website and writing a lot of content. And then all of a sudden, what ended up happening was somebody on Twitter, direct messaged me. And I didn't know who this person was. And it turned out to be that they were the director of web marketing at Remax, which is a real estate company. And, this is for all of Remax Canada. They said, "Hey, do you know anything about social media?" And I said, "I actually happen to know something about social media." Mm-hmm. He said, "Fantastic. Can you come down and speak at a conference that we're having for our realtors? There's going to be about 1500 people basically over there. And we want to talk, want you to talk about how to generate leads using social media for realtors." And I said, "Okay, when is this happening?" 3 days from now. Mm. So I got to building a deck basically and got to know Remax from there on in, and they've been clients of ours for the last now 7.5 years.
I see. So they, the first month, you started generating revenue from the first month onwards, right?
That's
What revenue did you generate in month one after incorporating?
I think it was somewhere in the range of $10,000 or $15,000 in the first month.
So you generated revenue and started having customers and you were ramping up your business in the first year. And within first year, you had to visit hospital for what?
This is right after we had hired our second employees. We were a team of three and I had a bout of appendicitis basically. So I had to go to the hospital and get that, get that taken care of. But lo and behold, what also ended up happening was I ended up having an infection, which landed me in the hospital on morphine for the next 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And at this time, you were like full on working your company and you were the main support for the company, right? So what happened to your company when you were out for 2 weeks?
Well, I think my clients were very understanding. I had my team was still doing the work that needed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
I did have a situation that I had to handle, which was on the second day after the operation, I had somebody who handed in their resignation while I was on morphine. So I remember getting the letter or reading the email, sorry, on my phone and being a little out of it, to be honest, at that point in time and trying to process all of that. So it was a very interesting and unique experience.
I see. So what happened? So he just ended up leaving that day or was it a 2 week notice and he was still there when you come back?
Well, it was 2 weeks notice, but by the time I had actually got back to work, it was 2 days. So I spent most of that 2 weeks not being able to work on any sort of transition because I was in the hospital.
I see. And you had some insight about hiring at that point, right? What was it?
My insight really was that you need to hire people that are aligned with your core values. Core values emanate out from, you know, the founder of really any company because they build a team of like-minded peers around them, like-minded employees and teammates. So if you don't have somebody who's aligned with your core values, then you're hiring purely for skill, then that is a ticking time bomb at the end of the day. It's not something that benefits the individual who's coming into the company. Mm-hmm. Doesn't benefit the company either. So it kind of hit home for me, basically, in terms of how important it is to evaluate new team members, especially when you have that small a team where one person is being added, that's a third, 33% of your team.
So this guy who handed in his 2 week notice at that time, you felt was not aligned with your core values?
Oh, for sure, no, because one of the values that we formalized later on is this concept of you over me, which is about being completely a service of others rather than thinking about oneself. And if you're practicing that, the idea is there's this boomerang effect of, you know, if you're more about other people, it's going to come back to you. So, you know, we Indians, we call that karma, right, at the end of the day. So this was not a good karmic decision, I think, overall for that particular person. But at the end of the day, you know, I wish them well. Mm-hmm. In the future, what I learned about that was if you hire people who are, you know, who have the same personal operating system as you do, they're going to make decisions the same way you would, because I would never quit on somebody when I have, you know, somebody else who needs me and is, you know, down and out on one leg, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. I got it. So, first year passed by and you had a lot of clients in the first year, right? In, how many clients did you have in the first year? How many clients did you serve?
Probably around 15 or 17.
15 or 17. And what was the revenue by the end of first year?
It was about $450,000.
Yeah, that was very impressive for a very first year for your first company, right? Were you, what was the excitement like at that time, at the end of first year?
So part of me was like, we were 50,000 short of $500,000. And I was like, ah, you know, like 10% short. Why did that happen? And so I realized the idea that, you know, you have to, like, I understood what revenue cycles were all about. Like the fact that you could, you know, when you book revenue and you realize revenue are completely different things. Mm-hmm. That's one. But I think the excitement really was to say, hey, we've got something over here now. This is working. We're creating value in the world and these clients are seeing their businesses grow and they're happy to work with us and, you know, invest basically in our growth as well. So I think that was a really exciting part.
And you also mentioned, not here when we were talking earlier, that at the time you were starting the business, there were some questions whether to go to the job world. Actually, you put down a job offer, right?
Job offer for what?
To start your own business after your undergrad.
Yeah.
Did you not? And it was like a six-figure job offer that you had.
I was working in a six-figure role at that point in time. And this was for the agency that I talked about, which worked with the Yellow Pages group. And I had to walk away from that six-figure role in a really great sort of management career track, basically, where, you know, my boss was basically the CEO of a company, and this company had existed for about 20 or 25 years prior. So they took a chance on me, and I'm forever grateful to them for an opportunity like that at the age of 19 or 20. But it was scary to walk away from that and kind of say, you know, I'm literally going from this consultant, Dev Basu consulting service or search marketing, basically, and the job to nothing. Mm-hmm. And then having to build up Powered by Search, which was unknown at the time, mm-hmm. and to build it with the sort of thought space of it's no longer just going to be a consulting, an individual consulting firm. It's going to become a company, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Where I was going with that was, walking away from that. And after first year, if you did 450K, which was four times more than what you were making in your full-time job, then that gave... must have given you some.
Oh yeah, it was hugely exciting. Yeah, it was exhilarating.
But you're so type A that you're also focused on the 50K that you missed. So, what were you helping a client with at that time? For example, what did you do for RE Max?
Right. So basically, what we help our clients do is help them connect with their best customers, both finding them and keeping them. And our sort of mantra around that is right time, right place, right person. And the way you do that, if you think about Google, you know, anytime you want to find a particular product or service, you're Googling that, right? You may not be Googling the brand name, but you might be Googling something like, I don't know, homes for rent in San Francisco or mm-hmm. something like that. And so you have, in this case, maybe Zillow would pop up for something like that because Zillow's got a page that accurately, it basically services that intent. Your intent is to find a home for rent in San Fran. Well, we helped RE/MAX with basically the same thing, but times many hundreds of thousands of types of searches. So we came in and we looked at how do we take all this information that RE/MAX has, which is, you know, every single house listing or condo listing that they carry, all the cities and areas that they have these listings in, and how do we basically create an experience that makes Google love their website? Mm-hmm. And so we did something known as technical SEO and site architecture consulting. And I don't want to get too geeky for a second here, but like we help basically Google understand the content, the context, and the code of their website. So the three mm-hmm. C's basically.
I see. So you restructured their websites and put content which is more Google friendly so that they will pop higher in the search engine. And that's what they're paying for. In 2011, you got FedEx as a client. And FedEx mm-hmm. is a huge enterprise customer for you. How'd you get them?
Right. So, I mean, it started off back to that local search. A lot of what the experiences that have happened to me in life has been a continuity of a multi-year journey, basically. So back when I was mentioning that I was interested in Google Maps, I noticed that there was a portion of the market that nobody was talking about. So most of the consultants who were doing great work in the space were talking about how to help mom and pop shops, individual locations that are independent stores or things like that. nobody was talking about companies that had many hundreds of locations. So I started speaking at conferences on the topic of how to rank 10, 100, or 1,000 locations. And it was very novel because nobody was talking about it or even thinking about how to, you know, scale basically that particular aspect. So when FedEx got in touch with us, it was for a website that they have called local.fedex.com, where they basically have over 3,000 stores, which are FedEx office and ground locations and things like that, that need to show up for not only branded terms when you're looking for them, but also non-branded terms, which are, you know, you're looking for what they do, essentially. Right. And so they got wind of, A, the content that we were creating. They got wind of the presentations and the conferences that, you know, we were speaking at. And that's, I think, how they landed up in contacting us.
I see. So the difference was, if I'm a Chinese restaurant, for example, and if you search for, and I'm only in San Jose, if I search for Chinese restaurants in San Jose, I will pop up. But if I'm P.F. Chang's and I'm in 1,000 locations, including San Jose, how do I show up in San Jose and San Francisco and Oakland? And is that
everywhere? Yes.
Got it. Yeah. So very quickly on the technical side, how do you scale from one mom and pop to this chain? You have to do the same thing that you did in mom and pop for multiple times, for 1,000 times in this example, right? Or is there something else that you would do which will impact all the locations at the same time?
So one of the things that I think we do very well is deconstruct basically how systems work. And so when you're thinking about doing it for a mom and pop chain, a mom and pop shop, you're really looking at it from a very micro level. So, you know, in this case, the three things that really matter in local search are you have to have a claimed profile on something known as Google My Business. You have to have something known as citations, which are basically references to that Chinese restaurant and different internet Yellow Pages directories. So think like Super Pages, Yellow Pages, Brown Book, and Yelp, and so on. And then you need to have reviews, because if you don't have any reviews at all, you're not relevant, basically. Now, the reviews could be good or bad. That doesn't really matter, but you need to have reviews. So those are sort of the building blocks of local search and being able to get good at it.
And that now, is same for mom and pop and...
It's the same thing for somebody who has 1,000 locations as well. But the way you go about it has an element of sophistication associated with it. So you wouldn't be just... manually repeating the process for every single one of those locations, that would be very inefficient. Mm-hmm. And so there's a system that we created to be able to scale this, where we were working with somebody known as a data aggregator. So these are basically companies where you submit the data for en masse basically to a data aggregator, and they send it out automatically to all these other directories. And then we were working with Google's teams to be able to make sure that, you know, the Google My Business listings for a large company were all accurate. Let me give you an analogy. If a Chinese restaurant's phone number is wrong in San Jose, that reflects badly on the Chinese restaurant for not being a good steward of its web presence. If all the phone numbers for a FedEx are wrong, it reflects badly on Google.
Hmm. Yeah. So Google has a motivation to help you.
That's right.
Yeah. Who is the data aggregator that you work with?
So a good example would be Moz Local. We've been working with Moz, which previously known as SEO Moz. They're a company based out of Seattle for many years, and they have a product called Moz Local, where if you can submit your data, your name, address, and phone number data in mass or for a single location, they will send it out to a number of other data aggregators as well. And so an example would be InfoUSA, Axiom, Localese, Newstar Localese, and Factual.
I see. I'm really interested in this local search engine, so I'm asking you,
more questions
about it. But let's move on. So you got FedEx as a client, and what impact did it have financially on your business? Did it double your revenue? Was it what impact financially?
I think it had it probably increased our revenues by, I'd say, 20 to 25% that year.
At this time, you were around the $1 million mark, right?
Yeah. We'd crossed it. So by 2012, we had just crossed $1 million. In 2013, about 1.8 million.
I see. And 20% out of that was coming from FedEx, which was huge.
Tell
us about the merger you had in 2014.
Yeah. So what was happening was, you know, I was running the business in very much a hub and spoke model, and I knew that that wasn't a very good way of growing the agency moving forward. So I had two peers, basically, within the industry had similar types of agencies as well that were small but growing. And I decided to merge with them in 2014. And that basically, you know, shot our team size up to 60, basically. And it doubled our revenues as well when we did that particular merger. So we went from like 1.8 to roughly 3.5 million in our first year by doing that particular merger.
I see. And what was your employee count before the merger?
I think it was like 17.
17 to 60 people. That's a four-time increase.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Okay. And you felt like you were not able to scale it up yourself and you needed help, or was it different aspects of the business that these other companies would bring to the table?
Well, it was a bit of both. Like, you know, if you, I don't know if you've read the book, The E-Myth, by, I think it's Michael or Scott Gerber, but he talks about this, this concept of having, in every person, there's an entrepreneur, there's a manager, and, what else do you talk about? That they're just a technician. And most of us start off as technicians in the sense that we're good at doing something. And then somebody comes along and says, hey, what if you did this for yourself and you were your own boss and you started, he uses the example of baking pies. Okay. So if you are really good at baking pies, somebody says you should have a pie shop and you go, fantastic. I should be my own boss. But then you realize once you start, you know, setting up this pie shop that you actually need to figure out a way of growing this business. You need to manage it. You need to do the accounting. You need to do the finance. You need to do a lot of different things, basically. And so because things like culture and operations and sales were so important, in many ways equally important for the growth of the business, I knew I needed somebody who was as dedicated as I was in growing the business. And I could only find that in a co-founder at that point in time. Or, you know, after the merger in another partner, essentially. And that's one of the reasons why I merged with these two companies.
I see. What were the two companies?
Yeah, so one of them was called Small Business Online Coach, and the other one's called Net Connections.
I see. Do they exist as separate websites even till today?
Probably not. I think they're either existing or redirecting, or they have a splash page about the merger.
I see. So, coming to the post-acquisition time, what challenges did you have in first year after acquisition?
So there were some that we expected and some that we didn't. So we knew that there would be a period of settling in, basically. What we didn't expect was that it would be like a blended family. So the idea here is that, you know, you had three very different sets of people in terms of our team, basically, coming together and trying to form and norm and storm basically into one cohesive team. And one of the things that we saw was, you know, Powered by Search, which is my company, prior to the merger, we all worked out of the same office. So we saw each other every single day. And then my partner Matthew's team was all virtual. So having some of these virtual people getting used to coming into an office was definitely a big shift for them. And then we had
them come to the office.
Yeah. We wanted them to integrate basically with the rest of the team. Yeah. And then on the flip side of it, you know, we had some of our people in the office going, well, it'd be nice for us to be able to work virtually. We've got all the tools and platforms needed to be able to have a virtual, you know, work presence basically. We can do this work. You know, I could be talking to you just as easily in the office today with the brick wall behind me or on a beach, right? As long as I have an internet connection and I've got this laptop in front of me. And that's the, you know, it still boggles my mind that we live in this day and age. But that being said, you know, we introduced a 2-day work from home policy at that point in time. To have a meeting of the, you know, best of both worlds kind of thing. And it worked to a certain extent, and in some cases it didn't. And so the entire first year was a lot of like just being able to figure out who we were cohesively as a new company.
Can you give an example of when it did not work?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I think that it definitely didn't work when we had to have tough conversations, especially if it was a tough conversation with an employee that came from one of the other merged companies, because, you know, they would have a stronger bond with their former boss, essentially.
Yeah. Be more specific. What was the tough conversation? How did it go bad? Because I want to understand what was the challenge so that we.
So let's suppose that somebody made an error of some kind, right? And they either, you know, there was a performance issue, a client management issue, maybe they were late on reporting. These are three unique things that have actually happened. And And I, as a CEO, would go up maybe and talk to them and say, hey, like, you know, this is not acceptable. Here's how we need this to happen. What do you need for us to help you with this so that it doesn't happen next time around? And then I know that there would be a side conversation where they go talk to their old boss and kind of say, oh, Dev told me this and this and this, you know, and there would, it would create unnecessary friction basically. Okay. So the way we solved that was basically, you know, my partners and I got together and said, look, we are one company now at the end of the day. There's no sort of, you know, there's no stepfathers in the company, and so to speak. Mm. Let's all behave in that way. So if you do have somebody who approaches you this way, back the other partner up and say, no, he was right to do what he did. Because he's looking out for the best interest of all of us, not just, you know, any one person at the end of the day.
It was more mutual trust, and whether the old team members will trust the, you know, bosses from the new team and so on.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
And you had a financial loss too. You lost $500,000 in first year.
No, not in the first year. We lost $500,000 in 2015. So we had a client who was basically, they were a venture funded startup, and the startup went out of business after a year. But, you know, in that year, they were worth about $500,000 to us. And we pulled out all the stops for them. We were doing SEO, local search, paid search, conversion rate optimization, and marketing automation as well.
Mm-hmm. And what was the company again?
So there was a company called Zucasa.
Zucasa. What did they do?
So they were in the real estate space as well.
Okay.
And they were owned by a large telecom company called Rogers.
And they went bankrupt, and that's what hit your revenues in 2015. And it was not as much related to the culture or the merging of two companies.
No, not at all.
I wrote a note that it was $500,000 loss because of the merger, but
no.
I think I misunderstood. So you started making some cultural changes within the company. Like you said, 2 days out of the week of work from home. What was your vacation policy was like?
So we changed it in 2016, but in 2015, it was your standard sort of North American vacation policy. So anywhere between, you know, 2 and 4 weeks, basically, of vacation, depending on the seniority of the hire and the caliber and all that type of stuff. And we said, you know what, looking at this in 2016, we actually formalized something called our Vivid Vision, which is basically a document that talks about what Powered by Search looks, feels, and performs like in December of 2019. So it keeps one foot in the present and one foot out into the future, basically. And in that, we said, look, we have a mission to become a world-class company at what we do. We can only do that if we have world-class people. So what basically do world-class people look for? I mean, pay is definitely one component of it, but they look for many other things. They're looking for a sense of belonging. They're looking for a sense of personal development, and they're looking for balance in their life as well. So we actually changed our policies for paid time off and made it 5 weeks of paid time off for everybody in the company, whether you're, you know, a junior entry level person or you're very senior at the senior leadership team level.
Yeah. Is it okay to share the Vivid Vision document that you sent me with the audience?
Yeah, you bet. You bet.
Yeah. I'll leave it in the show notes as well. And it's a very engaging document, and it has a lot of conviction behind it, like the title suggests, Vivid Vision. For example, I'm in the our clients section, and it says on the first line, we attract the best clients, like a flame attracts a moth, and our clients instantly recognize we are different and special, and it goes on about how we need to take over the world with getting more clients. It has your core values, culture. So it's a very detailed document, and you had to lay it out to align with your financial vision also.
Yep.
And what was your financial vision? What is your financial vision for the next few years?
Yeah, so, you know, we're about a $6 million a year company right now. Our growth plan is to get to $28 million by the end of December 2019, as per our Vivid Vision. And that's our 3-year plan at this point in time. And the way we're going to do that is basically by making sure that all the other components of that Vivid Vision document are something that we're actually checking off and hitting, right?
Yeah.
So if we're not going to attract the best clients, we're not going to hit this goal. So it makes sense for us to attract the best clients. And to attract the best clients, we have to do the best work. The best work can only be done if we have the best team, and so on and so on.
Yeah. So apart from this Vivid Vision document, what else has been a part of this goal hitting of 28 million by 2019?
Right. So I think like you were on our last chat, you were talking about why the desire for that basically exists, right? So what we in the space we work in digital marketing, everything's very fragmented. I mean, even if you just look at the amount of software platforms available that help you figure out different components of digital, whether that's like creating images for social media or the number of platforms to help you manage ads, it's a plethora that becomes very confusing for a marketer. What we want to do is really transform that confusion to a place of clarity so that they can go, I know exactly what it takes to get from point A, where I am today, to point B, where I need to go. Mm-hmm. And I know that every company's got goals around how they want to grow. Every fast growth company that believes in their product and they believe that they create something that adds a lot of value to the market is simply looking for a way where, you know, if you're trying to feel like if I only had more sales, I'd be able to hit all my goals. If I only had more leads, I'd be able to hit my goals. Then those are the companies that we're looking to work with. And being able to hit that goal. But I think the ultimate sort of the big, hairy, audacious goal for us is, at least in Canada, and we have clients in the States basically as well, for any major company that's looking to make a distinct shift in the way they approach their digital strategy or transformation, we want to be part of that consideration process. Yeah. And if we did that, we're going to hit our, you know, both hit and surpass our Vivid Vision goals.
Yeah. So if you were to advise someone who is now getting started creating a digital marketing agency, you know, same thing, just replicating what you did. First of all, actually, is there still opportunity or is the space too crowded already?
No, there's always opportunity. You know, there's always opportunity in even the most crowded of spaces.
Yeah. So if someone is starting from scratch, someone is just finishing their undergrad and they say digital marketing, online marketing interests them, what advice do you have for them and what would you have done differently if you were to start over?
So what I would advise somebody who's starting in this space today is to become within the top 5% of worldwide experts at a very small niche topic. Mm-hmm. So an example would be something like, you know, I am the Instagram expert for the fashion industry. Mm-hmm. Well, that's super specific. You're not saying I'm a social media expert for the fashion industry, which is far more broad. You're an Instagram ads expert. You're a Facebook ads expert for surgeons or for like a cosmetic, you know, dentist or something like that. Well, pick a niche basically that you identify with, that you're passionate about, and then pick a way for growing those businesses within sort of the realm of digital and then become an expert in a very sort of specialized manner. And that's how you end up becoming the biggest fish in a small pond.
And what would you do differently if you were to start over today?
I'd probably focus on doing, you know, a lot more PR and speaking than we've done in the past. Like, in, you know, we've been very heads down growing the business, taking care of our clients and really working with them. And it's been, in some ways, somewhat insular. Where we're going now is you're going to start seeing a lot more content on media portals like, you know, Entrepreneur or Huffington Post. You're going to see a lot more powered by search and PR, a lot more speaking, basically. Because now, you know, we've been able to codify what we're about into words. So the Vivid Vision document is an example of that. We've created a framework called the Predictable Growth Framework. And that actually talks about how we do what we do in a very succinct sort of fashion. And so you're going to be seeing a lot more of that type of thing.
What's the framework? Did you share it publicly?
No, not yet. It's still under wraps, but there's going to be a course that comes out very soon that you know, both your viewers and everybody else will be able to take as well, where we introduce the concept of the framework and it actually has a canvas associated with it as well. Uh-huh. The idea basically is that, you know, it's a napkin marketing plan where you can do a self-assessment for how digitally ready you are to achieve your goals. Because the idea is that, you know, a goal without a plan is a pipe dream, basically. And if the plan is not feasible, it doesn't have smart goal setting essentially associated with it, you're not going to achieve it. So, you know, we looked at some of the frustrations that our clients had prior to working with us, and we actually mapped that down and said, here are some of the common things that are happening. That's what basically inspired the framework.
Is there any resources that you would recommend for someone that helped you either in business or in this particular industry of online marketing?
Yeah, so what I would recommend is if you are beginning as an entrepreneur, you want to be able to, you know, curate and read a couple, you apply the 80-20 rule. So figure out what are the top 20, you know, influential blogs and thought leaders in your industry and then go follow and read whatever they're basically talking about. But don't get inundated and read everything you potentially can, because there's going to be a ton of noise. The second thing, that if you already have a fledgling business and you're figuring out how to grow it, get a mentor. And it doesn't always mean that there's one mentor. There could be multiple mentors. You could join something like an entrepreneurs association type club of some kind and get in there and start basically sparring ideas with other entrepreneurs who are not in the same business. You can learn a lot more from businesses that are not like yours than ones that are. And they'll be much more free and willing to talk about those things basically as well. And then the third tip, the most important one, I think, is talk to your clients, basically. Talk to your clients and ask them, what is something that is keeping you up at night? What are some problems that you wish you could solve if you had a magic wand that you haven't been able to solve today? But the key thing is being curious, like actually giving a shit about how to improve their businesses. You'll find lots of opportunity just by being able to do those three things.
Yeah. One thing I would add on the last one is talk to your clients now, before starting the product, before building everything.
Yes.
And not wait for it until later.
Yes.
It's easy to say, but sometimes it may be hard to follow.
So, yes, very, very true. Yeah.
Yeah. I wish you all the very best, Dave, for your $28 million by 2019 plan, and I wish you good luck.
Yeah. Thanks, Rohit. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
All right. Take care.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again, and have an amazing day.